Section 3, Unity and Sectionalism, An American Story. Following the War of 1812, Americans felt buoyed by a new sense of pride and faith in the United States. In his inaugural address on March 4, 1817, President James Monroe expressed this feeling of proud nationalism. "If we look to the history of other nations, ancient or modern, we find no example of a growth so rapid, so gigantic, of a people so prosperous and happy." The Era of Good Feelings. The absence of major political divisions after the War of 1812 helped forge a sense of national unity. In the 1816 presidential election, James Monroe, the Republican candidate, faced almost no opposition. The Federalists, weakened by doubts of their loyalty during the War of 1812, barely existed as a national party. Monroe won the election by an overwhelming margin. Although the Federalist Party had almost disappeared, many of its programs gained support. Republican President James Madison, Monroe's predecessor, had called for tariffs to protect industries, for a national bank, and for other programs. Political differences seemed to fade away, causing a Boston newspaper to call these years the Era of Good Feelings. The president himself symbolized these good feelings. Monroe had been involved in national politics since the American Revolution. He wore breeches and powdered wigs, a style no longer in fashion. With his sense of dignity, Monroe represented a united America, free of political strife. Early in his presidency, Monroe toured the nation. No president since George Washington had done this. He paid his own expenses and tried to travel without an official escort. Everywhere Monroe went, local officials greeted him and celebrated his visit. Monroe arrived in Boston, the former Federalist stronghold, in the summer of 1817. About 40,000 well-wishers cheered him, and John Adams, the second president, invited Monroe to his home. Abigail Adams commended the new president's unassuming manner. Monroe did not think the demonstrations were meant for him personally. He wrote Madison that they revealed a desire in the body of the people to show their attachment to the Union. 2 years later, Monroe continued his tour, traveling as far south as Savannah and as far west as Detroit. In 1820, President Monroe won re-election, winning all but one electoral vote. Reading check. Describing. Why was this period called the Era of Good Feelings? Sectionalism grows. The Era of Good Feelings did not last long. Regional differences soon came to the surface, ending the period of national harmony. Most Americans felt a strong allegiance to the region where they lived. They thought of themselves as Westerners or Southerners or Northerners. This sectionalism, or loyalty to their region, became more intense as differences arose over national policies. The conflict over slavery, for example, had always simmered beneath the surface. Most white Southerners believed in the necessity and value of slavery. Northerners increasingly opposed it. To protect slavery, Southerners stressed the importance of states' rights. States' rights are provided in the Constitution. Southerners believed they had to defend these rights against the federal government infringing on them. The different regions also disagreed on the need for tariffs, a national bank, and internal improvements. Internal improvements were federal, state, and privately funded projects, such as canals and roads, to develop the nation's transportation system. Three powerful voices emerged in Congress in the early 1800s as spokespersons for their regions: John C. Calhoun, Daniel Webster, and Henry Clay. John C. Calhoun. John C. Calhoun, a planter from South Carolina, was one of the war hawks who had called for war with Great Britain in 1812. Calhoun remained a nationalist for some time after the war. He favored support for internal improvements and developing industries, and he backed a national bank. At the time, he believed these programs would benefit the South. In the 1820s, however, Calhoun's views started to change, and he emerged as one of the chief supporters of state sovereignty, the idea that states have autonomous power. Calhoun became a strong opponent of nationalist programs such as high tariffs. Calhoun and other Southerners argued that tariffs raised the prices that they had to pay for the manufactured goods they could not produce for themselves. They also argued that high tariffs protected inefficient manufacturers. Daniel Webster. First elected to Congress in 1812 to represent his native New Hampshire, Daniel Webster later represented Massachusetts in both the House and the Senate. Webster began his political career as a supporter of free trade and the shipping interests of New England. In time, Webster came to favor the Tariff of 1816, which protected American industries from foreign competition, and other policies that he thought would strengthen the nation and help the North. Webster gained fame as one of the greatest orators of his day. As a United States senator, he spoke eloquently in defense of the nation as a whole against sectional interests. In one memorable speech, Webster declared, "Liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Henry Clay. Another leading war hawk, Henry Clay of Kentucky, became Speaker of the House of Representatives in 1811, and a leader who represented the interests of the Western states. He also served as a member of the delegation that negotiated the Treaty of Ghent, ending the War of 1812. Above all, Henry Clay became known as the national leader who tried to resolve sectional disputes through compromise. The Missouri Compromise. Sectional tension reached new heights in 1820 over the issue of admitting new states to the Union. The problem revolved around slavery. The South wanted Missouri, part of the Louisiana Purchase, admitted as a slave state. Northerners wanted Missouri to be free of slavery. The issue became the subject of debate throughout the country, exposing bitter regional divisions that would plague national politics for decades. While Congress considered the Missouri question, Maine, still part of Massachusetts, also applied for statehood. The discussions about Missouri now broadened to include Maine. Some observers feared for the future of the Union. Eventually, Henry Clay helped work out a compromise that preserved the balance between North and South. The Missouri Compromise, reached in March 1820, provided for the admission of Missouri as a slave state and Maine as a free state. The agreement banned slavery in the remainder of the Louisiana Territory, north of the 36-degree 30-minutes north parallel. Reading check. Identifying. What issue did the Missouri Compromise address? How did the northern and southern attitudes toward slavery differ? The American system. Though he was a spokesperson for the West, Henry Clay believed his policies would benefit all sections of the nation. In an 1824 speech, he called his program the American System. The American system included a protective tariff, a program of internal improvements, especially the building of roads and canals, to stimulate trade, and a national bank to control inflation and to lend money to build developing industries. Clay believed that the three parts of his plan would work together. The tariff would provide the government with money to build roads and canals. Healthy businesses could use their profits to buy more agricultural goods from the South, then ship these goods northward along the nation's efficient new transportation system. Not everyone saw Clay's program in such positive terms. Former President Jefferson believed the American system favored the wealthy manufacturing classes in New England. Many people in the South agreed with Jefferson. They saw no benefits to the South from the tariff or internal improvements. In the end, little of Clay's American system went into effect. Congress eventually adopted some internal improvements, though not on the scale Clay had hoped for. Congress had created the Second National Bank in 1816, but it remained an object of controversy. McCulloch v. Maryland. The Supreme Court also became involved in sectional and states' rights issues at this time. The state of Maryland imposed a tax on the Baltimore branch of the Second Bank of the United States, a federal institution. The bank refused to pay the state tax, and the case, McCulloch v. Maryland, reached the court in 1819. Speaking for the court, Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that Maryland had no right to tax the bank because it was a federal institution. He argued that the Constitution and the federal government received their authority directly from the people, not by way of state governments. Those who opposed the McCulloch decision argued that it was a loose construction of the Constitution, which says that the federal government can coin money, gold, silver, and other coins, but the Constitution does not mention paper money. In addition, the Constitutional Convention had voted not to give the federal government the authority to charter corporations, including banks. Gibbons v. Ogden. Another Supreme Court case, Gibbons v. Ogden, established that states could not enact legislation that would interfere with congressional power over interstate commerce. The Supreme Court's ruling strengthened the national government. They also contributed to the debate over sectional issues. People who supported states' rights believed that the decisions increased federal power at the expense of state power. Strong nationalists welcomed the ruling's support for national power. Reading check. Examining. Why was the court's decision in Gibbons v. Ogden significant? Foreign affairs. The War of 1812 heightened Americans' pride in their country. Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, wrote from England to her sister back in Massachusetts, "Do you know that European birds have not half the melody of ours, nor is their fruit half so sweet, nor their flowers half so fragrant, nor their manners half so pure, nor their people half so virtuous?" At the same time, many Americans realized that the United States needed peace with Britain to grow and develop. It had to put differences aside and establish a relationship with the old world. Relations with Britain. In the years following the War of 1812, President Monroe and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, moved to resolve long-standing disputes with Great Britain and Spain. In 1817, in the Rush-Bagot Treaty, the United States and Britain agreed to set limits on the number of naval vessels each could have on the Great Lakes. The treaty provided for the disarmament, the removal of weapons, along an important part of the border between the United States and British Canada. The second agreement with Britain, the Convention of 1818, set the official boundary between the United States and Canada at the 49th parallel. The convention created a secure and demilitarized border, a border without armed forces. Through Adams' efforts, Americans also gained the right to settle in the Oregon Country. Relations with Spain. Spain owned East Florida and also claimed West Florida. The United States contended that West Florida was part of the Louisiana Purchase. In 1810 and 1812, Americans simply added parts of West Florida to the states of Louisiana and Mississippi. Spain objected but took no action. In April 1818, General Andrew Jackson invaded Spanish East Florida, seizing control of two Spanish forts. Jackson had been ordered to stop Seminole raids on American territory from Florida. In capturing the Spanish forts, however, Jackson went beyond his instructions. Luis de Onís, the Spanish minister to the United States, protested forcefully and demanded the punishment of Jackson and his officers. Secretary of War Calhoun said that Jackson should be court-martialed, tried by a military court, for overstepping instructions. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams disagreed. Geography. Adams-Onís Treaty. Although Secretary of State Adams had not authorized Jackson's raid, he did nothing to stop it. Adams guessed that the Spanish did not want war and that they might be ready to settle the Florida dispute. He was right. For the Spanish, the raid had demonstrated the military strength of the United States. Already troubled by rebellions in Mexico and South America, Spain signed the Adams-Onís Treaty in 1819. Spain gave East Florida to the United States and abandoned all claims to West Florida. In return, the United States gave up its claims to Spanish Texas and took over responsibility for paying the $5 million that American citizens claimed Spain owed them for damages. The two countries also agreed on a border between the United States and Spanish possessions in the west. The border extended northwest from the Gulf of Mexico to the 42nd parallel, and then west to the Pacific, giving the United States a large piece of territory in the Pacific Northwest. America had become a transcontinental power. Reading check. Identifying. What areas did the United States obtain from Spain? Latin American republics. While the Spanish were settling territorial disputes with the United States, they faced a series of challenges within their empire. In the early 1800s, Spain controlled a vast colonial empire that included what is now the southwestern United States, Mexico and Central America, and all of South America except Brazil. In the fall of 1810, a priest, Miguel Hidalgo, led a rebellion against the Spanish government of Mexico. Hidalgo called for racial equality and the redistribution of land. The Spanish defeated the revolutionary forces and executed Hidalgo. In 1821, Mexico gained its independence, but independence did not bring social and economic change. Bolivar and San Martin. Independence in South America came largely as a result of the efforts of two men. Simón Bolívar, also known as the Liberator, led the movement that won freedom for the present-day countries of Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, Bolivia, and Ecuador. José de San Martín successfully achieved independence for Chile and Peru. By 1824, the revolutionaries' military victory was complete, and most of South America had liberated itself from Spain. Portugal's large colony of Brazil gained its independence peacefully in 1822. Spain's empire in the Americas had shrunk to Cuba, Puerto Rico, and a few other islands in the Caribbean. The Monroe Doctrine. In 1822, Spain had asked France, Austria, Russia, and Prussia, the Quadruple Alliance, for help in its fight against revolutionary forces in South America. The possibility of increased European involvement in North America led President Monroe to take action. The president issued a statement, later known as the Monroe Doctrine, on December 2, 1823. While the United States would not interfere with any existing European colonies in the Americas, Monroe declared, it would oppose any new ones. North and South America are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonialization by any European powers. In 1823, the United States did not have the military power to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine nevertheless became an important element in American foreign policy and has remained so for more than 170 years. Reading check. Evaluating. How did the Monroe Doctrine affect foreign policy?